Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review.
Governor Tony Evers asked the U.S. Supreme Court to allow absentee ballots to be counted by 8 p.m. on November 9. Evers also says he'll fight a Sawyer County judge's ruling that temporarily blocked his 25% occupancy order. And state officials say telecom giant Foxconn missed hiring and investment targets in 2019, so it won't get any tax credits for its giant Mount Pleasant plant. Rewind, your week in review for October 16th.
I'm Steve Walters.
I'm J.R. Ross.
Well, J.R., let's talk about our governor going to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's pretty unusual, but let's talk about the petition that he filed. He petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to join the lawsuit over when an expected 1.1, 1.2 million potential absentee ballots must be submitted. He cited the surge of COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations. He asked that the Supreme Court go back to a lower court's ruling that absentee ballots could be counted through 8 p.m. on November 9. He also included a legal brief that asked for two other things: allow voters to receive replacement ballots via email until October 29, waive the requirement that election workers must live in the county in which they work the polls. That had been approved by, again, that lower court ruling, Judge Conley. And in his legal brief, he said, the extensions pertain to absentee ballots will only encourage, not confuse, voters. JR, your take before we hear from the governor on that?
So remember, the governor asked the court to consider the petition, because you can't go to the court and say, hey, here's my brief, you got to take it. So the court is still considering whether to even take the appeal. But what stuck out to me was that in both the request, hey, will you please look at this, and if you do, here's my argument, he rips the legislature. He basically says these guys have not done anything about COVID for months, and I've been the one through my, you know, the executive branch doing all this stuff that gives you a better picture of the dire situation we face in Wisconsin. So it underscores the tension between Evers and lawmakers about COVID-19 to me.
Yeah, it says in that brief that you and I've read that the governor's office is in the best place to deal with the pandemic. Okay, yesterday I did a fascinating newsmakers interview with the governor, and I asked him, why did you file with the U.S. Supreme Court? Here's his answer, please.
Let's talk about your petition yesterday before the Supreme Court. Why is it so important, some of the issues that you raised, sir?
It is important that people's votes are able to be counted. And, you know, Wisconsin has embraced voting by mail, and they'll continue to do that. And I think it's reasonable that if somebody gets their ballot into the clerk on time or postmarked on time, that they're able to have that vote counted. So we'll see. We were successful, frankly, in April to extend that, and hopefully we'll get some extension. It just makes sense. I wish we could change the law in time, but that's not going to happen.
Okay, so JR, another major development. A Sawyer County judge, let me get his name right, Judge John Yackel, the Tavern League of Wisconsin, the Tavern League of Forest County, and a bar and restaurant, the Flambeau Forest Inn, filed suit asking that the 25% occupancy limit be declared null and void. And Judge Yackel, citing the inherent power of one circuit court judge, issued a temporary restraining order blocking it until Monday. Now, JR, does this mean that apart from the municipalities that have their own separate rules on number of customers in restaurants and bars, Milwaukee and Madison, are there no limits, at least for the weekend, on some of these businesses?
Yeah, so a couple of things I thought were interesting about this decision. One, again, I'm not a lawyer, but I talked to several this week. It is rare to have a judge receive a request for a restraining order and to issue it without even asking the other side, do you want to weigh in and say anything about this? So that's number one. Number two, remember, there's a hearing scheduled for Monday for further arguments, so we'll see what the judge does. But again, a couple of lawyers I talked to think if he's going to move this quickly, on the restraining order. It's probably a sign of where he's at in terms of the merits of the case. And the bigger picture to them was that this, there's kind of a silver lining for Evers. It tees up the opportunity to go back to the state Supreme Court and rehash arguments about the powers of DHS secretary. Remember, back in May, the state Supreme Court in a 4-3 decision said that what Andrea Palm had done at the governor's direction in terms of extending state home order should have been issued as an administrative rule. In the administrative rule process, it gives lawmakers input and oversight of those orders. The Evers administration says, no, we don't believe that was their case. And in issuing this new order and limits on the capacity, it said, we believe that those powers were not touched by the Supreme Court decision. Well, if you go back to the court, don't forget, 4-3 in May, we have now replaced conservative Justice Daniel Kelly with liberal Jill Karofsky. We don't always know where judges are going to end up, but there's a pretty good feeling that Jill Karofsky would be more sympathetic to the Evers argument than Kelly was. You know, by the way, Brian Hagedorn again becomes a key swing vote, right? And Brian back in May said that he did not believe that Andrea Palm had to go through the administrative rules process to issue that order, that and that the lawmakers don't have standing to challenge the law. If he sticks to his original position, that's probably a good thing for the Evers folks if they go back to court. The question is, when might they get there? Because remember, this has got to go through now a circuit court judge, then you might go through the appeals court, and then the state Supreme Court. So it could be a while, but it's queued up for a good thing for Evers in restoring, possibly restoring the powers of the DHS secretary.
Right. And I asked the governor yesterday in my Newsmakers interview, which I recommend people view. It's a fascinating interview. Is the state going to appeal this? And he said, oh, yes, but the state obviously is going to wait for the outcome of Monday's hearing, which could go with the judge extending the temporary, issuing an injunction, excuse me, or dismissing the lawsuit. Right, JR?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now let's talk about this fascinating back and forth in the Capitol. I want to go back to what you just said, and let's talk about the process. The governor issues the 25% occupancy rule limit, and legislators do not come back to the Capitol to rescind it. However, as you said, Joint Committee on on Review of Administrative Rules. Do I have that right, JR? Okay. What a term. What a name. They come in and they, let me get it right, Republicans on the legislature's Joint Committee on Review of Administrative Rules vote to require DHS to submit a 25% occupancy limit rule by November 11. Remember that date, November 11. Secretary Palm's order, unless extended, was scheduled to expire on November 6th. And the governor, as we'll hear in a minute, when we get into the back and forth, we'll talk about why they're not going to submit the rule. But JR, I want to ask you about this, the dates. The election, November 3rd. The rule expires November 6th, and the Joint Committee on Review of Administrative Rules gives the Evers administration till November 11. So these two dates, November 6th, when the rule expires, November 11, when the committee wants the rule, are past the election. Connect those dots for me.
Well, I'm not sure there's connection to the election. I mean, there's some Republicans who've kind of tried to make the case that there's something afoot here of Evers trying to discourage them from voting in person. Not really seen evidence of that from other places. But to me, the big thing is Ryan Nielsen, the governor's chief legal counsel, said the vote on Monday was a quote unquote pointless exercise. The reason he said that was the order expires before they had deadline to submit the rules. So they're not going to go through the process. The Evers administration unveiling this order said it was trying to get through two infection cycles. So typically, and again, I'm not a lawyer or a doctor, but typically you see a 14-day window, right, from exposure to when things are cleared. They're trying to get through two of those cycles to try and tamp down the numbers because we continue to be top three or four states in the country for a number of COVID cases, I believe both per capita and for the raw number. We are not in the top three states in the country for population, by the way. So they're trying to get through something to tamp this down and help flatten the curve with the hospitals. But again, the order basically is not going to matter because the order expires before them.
Okay, and now I want to introduce a video, but let me set the stage for the video. By online, Democratic Representative Gary Hebel accuses the Republicans on this committee of having, quote, his term, blood on your hands. Just a footnote, yesterday in my interview with the governor, I asked the governor, do you agree with that term, blood on your hands? He said yes. So you're going to hear Representative Hebel used that term. Republicans, because of their inaction, have blood on their hands, point one. Point two, Republican Senator Steve Noss is going to say in the video you're about to hear, it's not about COVID. It's about the governor following state law when he must adopt an emergency rule. Then you'll hear the governor, and then you'll hear the governor's chief legal counsel, Ryan Nielsen-Stoon, make the point that JR just made. Please.
What is your plan? Do you have anything at all? You have blood on your hands by not taking any action to save our citizens from this horrible epidemic.
Well, what we've heard from the opposition is an attempt to deflect from the issue of the Department of Health not obeying the law. We do have, as was mentioned, the LRB analysis pointing out the fact that this flies in the face of the Supreme Court decision earlier this year. This is not a debate on COVID. It's a debate on whether DHS is following the law. And I would argue they are not following the law. They are breaking the law. We're not debating COVID. We're debating whether government should go beyond the consent of the governed. And that's why we're here. And we are here to stop that. It's called doing your job.
We don't have a rule prepared. There's no reason to have a rule prepared because we have an emergency order that is in place in the state of Wisconsin.
I think it's also worth pointing out on that JCRAR meeting yesterday, it was a pointless exercise. Under statute, when JCRAR orders an agency to promulgate a rule, they can only do so under limited circumstances, which, as the governor said, just don't apply here. And secondly, when JCRAR does order so, there's a 30-day deadline to do so, and Emergency Order 3 expires days beforehand. So there's absolutely, even if they were right on the law, there's no consequence for this. And it was, instead of actually taking concrete action to do something with the pandemic, instead it was a pointless exercise in order to make a political point. Nothing more and nothing less.
Staying on the court beat, JR, the ruling that you and I expected, frankly, last week when we taped the show a week ago, St. Croix County Judge R. Michael Waterman, we expected him at any point to issue a ruling in the request for an injunction to block the mask order, the governor's emergency mask order. He did so on Monday, and he tellingly said that the legislature hasn't come back in to act on this. And he turned down the injunction request. Now, it was filed by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which argued that the governor had illegally extended the mask order until November 21. And a footnote, the Marquette Law School poll says 72% of their respondents to the poll support the mask order. And Will says, we're going to appeal, and we'll may know soon whether that'll be to the Court of Appeals or ask the Supreme Court for what's called an original action. Please directly take the case. Now, just a couple quotes. First of all, from Rick Essenberg, president of the WIL, Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. It is with regret that the judge held that the governor can rule the state by decree for an unlimited amount of time with the acquiescence of the legislature. We look forward to making an appeal on this critical constitutional matter. And JR, before I give you a chance, a very important quote from Judge Waterman's ruling. The legislature's inaction is relevant, and it weighs against judicial intervention, especially when the requested intervention will have statewide impact. Okay, I took too much time. Your take on this ruling and the back and forth?
The judge basically said the legislature didn't do its job, and I'm not going to do it for him. Now, the judge noted that he's one circuit court judge, essentially. There are three private individuals who are part of this lawsuit, I believe, that was kind of led by Will. He's saying their interest would outweigh everybody else's, and he's like kind of backing away from wanting to take that kind of an order that have a statewide impact. But he comes to a couple points in that decision that lawmakers didn't do what it could do. Lawmakers didn't come in and take a vote. Now, lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, don't want to take a vote. Now, not all of them. I should say Republican leadership in the Assembly doesn't want to come in and take a vote because they know that vote would be toxic for their members. So they are shying away from that. And now they're in a catch-22 where some of their members and their base want the mask mandate to go away. They know the vote is bad for their moderate members, and the court's not overturning it. So what do you do, and how do you play this lawsuit going forward? And oh, by the way, the legislature got its hands kind of involved in this suit by filing a brief supporting the move to overturn the mandate or to issue a sort of injunction for any enforcement of it. That kind of ties them more to it. They're just in a box right now.
Well, another thing intrigues me, JR. You have two circuit court county judges from Western Wisconsin. A St. Croix County judge says, I'm not going to block the mask order. And you have the filing then quickly by the Tavern League, one motion with a Sawyer County judge who then turns around and issues a temporary restraining order, not an injunction, blocking the 25% occupancy limit. These are playing out in Western Wisconsin. Is that District 4 Court of Appeals or 3? Do you remember anyway?
I believe.
Okay. And it just strikes me as kind of ironic. One judge upholds the governor and another goes against it. You see any significance there?
Yeah, let's be honest. They're judge shopping. They're looking for a more favorable environment than going to Dane County. Dane County is a seat of government, but it's also the most liberal counties in the state, right? So they're not going to file a lawsuit like this in Dane County. They're trying to find a place to be more favorable to their argument, and they struck gold in one place but not in the other.
Okay. That's a very good point. Okay. In 2017, then-Governor Scott Walker and Republican legislators offered Foxconn a major incentive if they invested $10 billion and hired, what's the job number, 13,000 jobs. If they hired 13,000 full-time jobs at the Mount Pleasant facility or throughout Wisconsin, they could get tax credits worth $2.85 billion. Now, let's back it up a little bit. In 2018, there was a finding that Foxconn did not create enough jobs or invest enough, meet the targets, to get any tax credits. Monday, Missy Hughes, CEO of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, wrote Jay Lee, a Foxconn executive, saying, "We have determined that you neither met your hiring or investment targets for 2019. Therefore, you will not get any tax credits." Now, it's very interesting because she also said, let me read from my notes from her letter to Foxconn. There is a path open to win-win, which is an open appeal to let's negotiate a new contract. There's a different type of, her terms, incentive contracts that are available. But the heart of it is, in 2017, the contract with the Walker administration and Foxconn said, thou shalt build Generation 10-5 high-tech gizmos. I once heard them described as high-tech screens the size of two twin beds. They're no longer doing that. They are making a different product, plan to make a different product. Therefore, breach of contract, won't get that... Won't get the tax credits. And by the way, the legislature set aside, I checked with the Fiscal Bureau, $212 million to potentially award in tax credits to Foxconn had they qualified from both hiring and investment. I've taken too much time, JR. Give me your take on this before we hear from Missy Hughes.
Look, the writing was a bit on the wall for months. Don't forget, like back late last year, some correspondence came to light between the Evers administration and Foxconn basically saying, you from the Labor administration, you guys are not doing what you said you're going to do originally. Ergo, you're not meeting the contract. Ergo, you're not getting qualified for tax credits. And lo and behold, they said you didn't qualify. So this is not a surprise. The question becomes, what happens next? What's a company going to do? Will they negotiate a new contract? Because remember, at the time that the Walker administration signed this very lucrative deal for Foxconn, it wasn't just about Foxconn. It was about the potential for Foxconn to transform the economy in southeastern Wisconsin. Governor Evers Walker's called it Wisconn Valley, remember? It was going to be this transformative thing, or this campus that was going to have these industries that were like latch on to it and build out from there. That's not happening because Foxconn is not building the expansive plant it was before. Now, it's still a lot of concrete down there. There's still a lot of space or pictures every week or so showing you the progress. but is not the transformative investment that Wisconsin expected for the lucrative deal. I mean, if you talk to people, Republicans say, hey, look, a couple thousand jobs, 3,000 jobs, that's still a worthwhile investment. It's true. But at the level that Wisconsin promised, it's a different ballgame. That's not what most companies get for creating a couple thousand jobs with Foxconn as a line. So this is part of the challenge here. And I don't know where this is going to go. And oh, by the way, the presidential election complicates things because President Trump called this the eighth wonder of the world when it was signed and he was all giddy about it. I remember being told by Republicans that Scott Walker had sealed his reelection when he signed this contract for this giant project. It became an albatross for Walker. It is not getting better in terms of public perception of it. And if Trump's not there, what's your incentive as Foxconn to stick around? I'm not sure.
Well, JR, you remember the groundbreaking photo? President Trump, I believe Terry Goh, the founder of Foxconn, which, by the way, only had, 2019 sales of $178 billion with a B. But let's go back to that groundbreaking. President Trump, Terry Goh, U.S. House Speaker Paul Ryan, Governor Walker. Only one of those is kind of, Terry Goh ran for president of Taiwan and then withdrew. But, but the point is, Mr. Walker, Governor Walker, and Speaker Ryan are no longer there. It's just very, very fascinating. And meanwhile, the investment of local governments and the TIFs, all there's so many different things to be ironed out. But anyway, where I'm going with this, I had a good week this week. I had a chance to newsmake the governor and Missy Hughes. I asked her, Missy Hughes, was the original Foxconn deal a bad deal for Wisconsin? And I want to look up her notes. I want you to listen to what she said. She basically said it would not have returned the $2.85 billion. So let's listen to Missy Hughes when I ask her, was the original Foxconn deal a bad deal for Wisconsin taxpayers?
My responsibility when I have conversations with companies about these incentives, when we're trying to attract a company to come to Wisconsin, or we've got a good Wisconsin company that wants to do an expansion, is to think about the taxpayers' return on investment. And, you know, without this massive project, $2.85 billion is not going to return to the taxpayers that investment. And so we calibrate our incentives and the work that we do with other companies. We've got, Haribo is coming in and building a big factory for gummy bears. We calibrate what the return on investment is, and we've got formulas for that. And so that's what, we would do with Foxconn, and that's what we've talked about with Foxconn. We've made sure that Foxconn understands, look, we have a responsibility to the Wisconsin taxpayers.
Let's wrap up this subject by the official statement from Foxconn. It's a very diplomatic statement. WEDC's determination of ineligibility during ongoing discussion is a disappointment and a surprise that threatens good faith negotiations, implying that there could still be negotiations. Missy Hughes in the supporting document said, we've been talking to you since June about trying to redo this document. But now, one more quote from the state senator from their region, Republican Van Wongard. Foxconn continues to develop a world-class facility in Mount Pleasant and is quickly becoming a valued partner in southeastern Wisconsin's economic rejuvenation. JR, I don't expect Foxconn to play big in the November 3 elections. Do you?
Not necessarily, maybe around that area, but I'm not getting out, picking up a lot that's playing a role in, like, legislative races is more about COVID, that kind of thing. And, not really. But don't forget, Foxconn also has an option to try and sue the state to try and force it to pay these tax credits. There's all kinds of stuff that could happen. And when I raise the prospects about the company's future, I'm not saying that, like, Trump loses, it's a done deal, they just pull off completely. I mean, you could, there's absolutely all kinds of things. But the trajectory it's on right now is not showing it's going to become what it promised to be originally. The question is, what will it be? And I do get the impression that who's the president, how the Evers administration approaches this could impact that trajectory for the company about where it goes in Wisconsin from here.
Okay. And now let's go back to our feature, Battleground Wisconsin, Voices from the Campaign Trail. This is an unedited video clips from both campaigns who visited this week. This week, Eric Trump was in Menominee Falls. Ivanka Trump was in Hilbert, the Appleton area. Mike Pence was in, the Vice President Mike Pence was in Waukesha on Tuesday. And you'll be hearing from them, direct clips. And just a P.S., Senator Elizabeth Warren will be in Madison and Milwaukee on Saturday. President Trump scheduled to return to Janesville on Saturday. So, unedited, voices from the campaign trail, please.
Joe Biden would double down on the policies that have led to violence in America's cities. I mean, would you withdraw support for those who protect and serve, you only embolden those who would do harm to our families and our communities. I mean, it's no surprise Milwaukee has literally seen a 110% increase in homicides this year, all while Milwaukee's Democrat mayor has called for cutting 120 police officers from his 2021 budget.
We're in a much different place today than we were in March of this year in terms of what we know about the virus and how we can treat it when somebody has it. And that's why we have one of the lowest mortality rates in the world, because of the efficacy of these therapeutics, which were developed real time. Then he wanted to get the process immediately started on a vaccine. And what most people don't realize is just what a Herculean lift this was. So the vaccine, which will be delivered before the end of this year, he accomplished more in 6 to 7 months than would have been done in 6 to 7 years.
They want to pack the Supreme Court, and people don't fully understand what packing the Supreme Court means. I'm sure many of you in here do, because you're clearly into this stuff, but this isn't like adding another justice to the Supreme Court. It's literally taking a Supreme Court for the last 200 years that has been at 9 people, and adding another 10 people to the Supreme Court with radical left justices in there. I mean, think about that notion. One person asked him, well, don't you think Americans have the right to know whether or not you're going to quote-unquote pack the Supreme Court? He goes, no, they don't have the right to know. I'll tell them after the election is over. That's how pompous these people are.
The stock picker is in today, JR, rising.
Brad Paff, look, we've talked, I think, before that a lot of Democratic candidates for legislature had a significant financial advantage because the state parties raised so much money. Brad may be one of the best examples of that. He's been able to, by himself, outspend the GOP groups on the airwaves, broadcast cable, radio, and digital on the Google and Facebook platforms, okay? What I'm seeing now on the track the TV buys is that the groups that were backing Dan Capang Republican aren't spending the last couple weeks of the race. They're basically off the airwaves. Now, there's some smaller stuff, but in a significant way, there's not really any help for Dan right now. That tells me something. Groups pull out of races for two reasons. They're super confident the guys or gal is going to win, or super confident they're going to lose. If you look at what's happening, it seems that Brad is in the driver's seat for that race. And what I'm also seeing is money going elsewhere. The real fight is in the suburbs of Milwaukee right now in assembly seats. Green Bay, the Senate seat up there is a little toss-up. But you're seeing more chatter about Alberta Darling, a longtime Republican state senator from the suburbs of Milwaukee. Her seat was seen as like, yeah, it's suburban, but it's really Republican suburban. Well, now you're seeing like chatter about how bad the president's numbers are in suburban Milwaukee, that there's some real talk about maybe she's in trouble. Now, the caveat to all this is that legislative polling can be very difficult because it's a very small district. And they keep kind of tricky sometimes. That said, you know, talking to both sides of the aisle, they are seeing very good signs for Democrats right now, very bad for Republicans, and it's driven by the president. He's just struggling. And it's not just Milwaukee suburbs. It's Green Bay. It's over by the Twin Cities. The Wisconsin Realtors, through an advocacy fund, they are doing a six-figure buy to thank Shannon Zimmerman over in St. Croix area and John Mako up in the Green Bay area for their work. You don't do that 3 weeks out from election unless there's a problem for them. So it just tells you the depth of the issue in rural Wisconsin or suburban Wisconsin right now for Republicans.
Okay, we're in a time bide. You got about a minute for mixed and falling. Go.
All right, state finances. We got yet another signal that, you know what, it could have been worse. The Evers administration closed the books in fiscal year 1920. We're basically off $82.9 million in our ending balance or something like it for what we thought we were going to have when the budget was signed versus what was actually there June 30th. Now, that takes into account not just everything that happened with COVID, but all the bills that the governor signed from July 1st to June 30th, all the revisions, so changes in spending. So we're in okay shape. And now looking ahead to the next fiscal year, there's a lot of uncertainty. But we got three good things going for us. Number one, we mentioned Foxconn. $212 million is not going to that company from state coffers this fiscal year. That's going to help the bottom line. Number two, Evers administration has ordered another $301 million lapses that for state agencies. We'll find out the plans December 15th. That's going to help. And our rainy day fund is like somewhere around $700 million.
Yeah.
These are all three good things. One unknown, will the feds come in with more help for the states in another round stimulus package, another stimulus package? So keep tuned on that one.
15 seconds on falling. Go.
Go.
So mask opponents, just real quick. Governor has these guys in a box. He's up with a TV ad now touting his efforts on COVID-19, knocking Republicans. It also urges against the recall that, you know, don't forget that's been going on. And I just saw there's a new filing from a guy challenging the mask mandate with the state Supreme Court. We'll see if they take it. But Evers has just outplayed these guys, this mask issue, the whole way.
Okay. And just a programming note, a reminder that more than 200 campaign interviews, which are more important than ever in this era of COVID-19, are now at wisci.org. And I just want to call your attention, last week, fascinating campaign interviews with Derek Van Orden, the Republican running against Congressman Ron Kine, and a very lively exchange over the intelligence and the coming election, the threat of China, with 8th District Congressman Mike Gallagher. That's worth watching. Next week, the Election Commission meets on Tuesday, and more candidate interviews. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for October 16th.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.